Glad I got it right that time. I tried it earlier tonight and I said good morning. So, yes, it's been rather a long day. Anyway, moving on with the book of Ruth. As we've worked through the Old Testament, we're getting into more of the books of history. That's what they call this series of books that describe the events of the early part of Israel in the Promised Land. And one of the fascinating little books in this area is the book of Ruth. Lesson number 8 in our series. Why call a book Ruth? Well, the book was named after the main character, a Moabite woman. Her name probably meant friendship, although we don't know for sure where it came from. The exact origin is unknown, but even if it came from either the Moabite or the Hebrew languages, there probably wasn't too much of a difference between the two at that point, because the Moabites came from Lot and his daughter, and the Israelites came from Abraham. So they were related not terribly far back. So the name of Ruth could probably be translated as friendship in either language. Fun facts about the book of Ruth. Ruth is one of two Old Testament books that received its name from a woman, the other being Esther. And it is the only biblical book that received its title from an ancestor of Jesus. Just an interesting fact. A subtitle, if you were going to summarize the book of Ruth in a very short phrase, two key words, a few other words thrown in for necessary joining them together, you would say a faith for all. And I think the book of Ruth really describes how God intends for all people to be part of the children of God. Ruth chose Jehovah to be her God instead of the false gods of Moab. Following through on that decision earned her a place in the ancestral line of King David. Just think about it. If she'd chosen to return to Moab with her sister-in-law Orpah, then she would have been left out. She would have been a heathen idol worshiper. But instead, when she chose to go back to Israel with Naomi, she was blessed with being placed in the line of David. She was one of four women honored in the New Testament, actually, in the genealogies of Jesus. Matthew 1:5, we won't read it, but her name is mentioned as the wife of Boaz, the mother of Obed. In the book of Ruth, there are, not surprisingly, only a few key people. It's such a short book. One, Ruth. Obviously the main character. It's kind of about her. It's got her name. The one who gave the book the name. Really, it's a recounting of events that were set into motion through her commitment to her mother-in-law, also to the Israelite God. Another main character is Naomi. Now, this is Ruth's mother-in-law. As the Israelite in the situation, she was the one, the human part of the equation, that orchestrated the meeting and ultimately the marriage of Boaz and Ruth. Boaz was another key character. He was the kinsman redeemer. And we're going to look at that role a little bit later on tonight and give it a little bit more study. He was a rich man from Bethlehem. Evidently, he was an exception to the rule that every man did that which was right in his own eyes, because he evidently feared God, and he demonstrated his respect for God's law by putting it into practice and fulfilling the kinsman redeemer responsibilities. And then another key character in the book of Ruth is actually David. He is the king who came from the union of Boaz and Ruth. And I believe he may have been one key reason the book was written. More on that later. Who wrote the book? If you're going to talk about why a book was written, it's kind of important to know who wrote it. I believe it's probably wise to say that the author was Samuel. But I can't provide a verse or a passage in the Bible that specifically says this book was written by Samuel. Instead, let's walk through why I believe he is the best option. First, Jewish tradition recognizes him as the author. Now, there are a lot of times when tradition is not right, and it's important to recognize that although tradition can be good, it is not on the level of Scripture. But in this case, it does lend support to the argument, just not proof. Another reason is that Samuel anointed David as king, so he knew that God had chosen him to be the king. Then, moving on, we determined that Samuel was most likely the author of Judges. These events kind of describe the whole character of the nation of Israel during the time of the Judges, a period of about 350 or so years. He was the first real prophet to come after Joshua at the end of that time, and he is the best fit for the contextual clues in Judges. We discussed this last week, that there was no king in Israel. Well, to write that there was no king in Israel, one would probably need to know that there was eventually going to be a king. But then also, if you look at Judges, the Jebusites were still in control of Jerusalem, which was changed as soon as David became king. So that leaves a time roughly during the reign of Saul when the book of Judges would have been written. But then I believe that Ruth forms an encouraging postscript to the book of Judges. The key phrase in the book of Judges is that every man did that which was right in his own eyes. Judges 1 through 16 records Israel's general failures and the judges that God sent. So in here we've got the stories of Samson, Gideon, but also you've got the recurring spiral that went down and down and down through the years as the Israelites rebelled from following God, worshipped the gods of the pagan Canaanites. Then when God sent a judging nation to come and enslave them for a period of time, they realized, oh yeah, we should be worshiping God instead. At that point, God sent a judge who delivered them, and ultimately they started the cycle all over again. Every time, however, they got into a worse and worse spiral going down. So in those chapters, the general failures, the judges that God sent, are recorded. The end of the book records two specific events of how Israel sank into depravity. The first is Judges 17 through 18. It records Micah and the Danites committing idolatry with setting up their own altar, their own gods, and adopting the worship that Jehovah had described for himself into their own pagan practices. And then later on, chapters 19 through 21, the events, the actions of the Benjaminites, the very depraved actions of the Benjaminites, really show how evil Israel had become as a whole. But then Ruth comes after the book of Judges, and some people actually will say that it's the end of the book of Judges, kind of forms the third part in the series. So Micah and the Danites would be the first part, the Benjaminites would be the second part, but then you end on a positive note with Ruth. Ruth records the faithfulness of an Israelite man and a Moabite woman. And since Samuel wrote Judges, it makes sense that he would also continue on then and record the happier events of Ruth. Ruth may have been written then to explain the presence of an alien in King David's immediate family tree. So as Samuel wrote the book of Judges, he arrived at a conclusion, if you believe that he wrote it during the time of Saul, which we've established in the past. But then he wouldn't necessarily have had a reason to continue and write the book of Ruth until he went and anointed David to be king. To kind of explain why a king actually had a foreigner in his family tree, very soon in his family tree. For the Israelites, genealogies were and really still are very important. You can see that if you look in the New Testament at the early parts of the Gospels, Matthew and Luke. The genealogy of Jesus is given twice in those passages. Therefore, it must have been especially important to establish the king's legitimacy. So everybody kept track of their genealogies. Who more importantly than the king? Really, by the king is the one that the nation, as the king goes, so goes the nation. And especially for King David, who ultimately was the ruler through whom the Messiah came. showing that Ruth, then, a Moabite, had demonstrated more faith in Yahweh during the wicked time of the judges, probably put to silence a lot of the accusations that she was a foreigner that didn't belong in the family tree. So I believe that Samuel probably wrote Ruth as a sequel to Judges after he anointed David to be king instead of Saul. A date? Well, approximately 1000 BC. It would be after, as I just said, he anointed David, but not at the same time that he wrote the book of Judges, because he's adding on to the events. And if you were to summarize Ruth in a sentence, I believe you could say that God demonstrates acceptance of all who will obey his commands, regardless of their nationality. So it's kind of expounding on our little short phrase, but I do believe this is a theme in the book of Ruth, probably one of the key themes, that God demonstrates acceptance of all who will obey his commands, regardless of their nationality. In looking at the book, it's important to establish something of a background, what happened leading up to the book, the book's writing. So let's, as we've done in the past several weeks, review what's happened in the Bible up till now. Genesis, God has called Abraham's descendants to be his chosen people, the Israelites. But then in Exodus, they have gone down into Egypt, and God has called them up out of Egypt so they can come and worship him. Leviticus, God calls his people, in addition to worshiping him, he tells them that he wants them to be holy because holiness is a part of his character that is absolutely vital. Numbers, God punished his people because they disobeyed him, demonstrating great disbelief in his promises. As they looked at the promised land, they saw not the benefits, not the promised blessing that God had promised them all along. They saw the giants. They saw the difficult walls, the difficult cities that it would be, that would be required for them to destroy. And they decided that they didn't want to go in. And God had to punish them. Deuteronomy. After the book of Numbers, when the Israelites wandered in the wilderness for 40 years, they have finally come back to the Jordan River and are ready to enter the land a second time. At this point, Deuteronomy, God repeats his law for this new generation prior to their entering the promised land. You see, the entire first generation had died in the wilderness as a result of their sin. And then Joshua. After Deuteronomy, the people are in the promised land, and God enabled Joshua, Moses' replacement, to organize the initial stages of conquest, dividing up the land, taking several of the key cities. He forced his way through into the middle, went south, then went north. Then he sent people out to survey the land and decide who got what share of the inheritance. Moving on into Judges, it's very quickly demonstrated that without a leader or king, Israel as a nation failed to maintain their commitment to Jehovah. They failed in their part of the theocracy, the government that is run directly by God. They failed to obey his word. And you know, this was so quickly, one generation after they came into the land of Israel. So after the book of Judges comes Ruth. And Ruth really demonstrates another time of transition for Israel. Because Samuel is telling us that although there was no king in the past, God has been working all through that time to form the kingly line through which the Messiah was going to come. So even though the people had been begging for a king and God had said no, he was still working to bring about the kingly line. And there are two places in the book of Ruth. After you look at the background, it's important to talk about where it happened. The first is Bethlehem. The story starts in Bethlehem and ends in Bethlehem. Bethlehem is a city located in the tribe of Judah, northwest of the Dead Sea. It is the location of Rachel's, or Jacob's wife, her tomb. It became famous as the city of David, the Messiah, several hundred years later, was born there. And it was part of the promised land. Now that little fact may seem obvious, but it was important for the story. The second location, Moab. This was a country located outside of the Promised Land, outside of Canaan, to the east of the Jordan River, east of the Dead Sea. The Moabites were descendants of Lot's daughter, and many times throughout Israel's early history, they were a pain in the neck. They kept on attacking. They really, if you remember in the book of Numbers, they were the result of a major punishment that Israel received. Many people died as a result of this country. The king of Moab asked Balaam to come and curse Israel. That was the king of Moab that was trying to come and attack Israel, destroy them. So relatives, yes, not such good terms. Later on, Moab was cursed by God because it practiced human sacrifice to Moloch. Moloch was the god of war who gave victory in battle if he was properly honored with human sacrifices. At least that's what they believed. Now, the whole book starts with Naomi's family moving to Moab, rebelling against God's wishes and moving to Moab. Why is that important? Well, they left to find bread because they had none in Israel. That indicates a couple of things. One, it indicates that Israel was rebelling because God had promised that when they obeyed, they would have bread. They didn't have bread, so they must have been in sin already. It indicates a second thing. Elimelech, the leader in the family, did not really trust God for his provision and wanted to seek the easy way out. Elimelech took his rebellion one step further by leaving the promised land of blessing and going to the land that was cursed by God for its wickedness, a land that historically had been an enemy to his people. For a time, no doubt, as they entered Moab, they found rest. They felt that they had what they needed. They had the bread that they had lacked in Israel. But soon, God took the lives of the men that should have been leading the family to obey God's wishes. It started with Elimelech. It wasn't long before Elimelech died in Moab. But then, Elimelech's two sons, Mahlon and Chilion, were killed by God as well because they were also disobeying God. They took Moabite wives. That was the source of the problem in Numbers. When the Israelites came and took Moabite wives, God sent a plague. And Mahlon and Chilion are doing it again. They died. When Naomi was left to herself, she decided to return to Israel. But when she returned, she described herself not as Naomi, but as bitter, because she had been on the receiving end of God's judgment. I think now there is a good piece of application to be made. God has a particular place, a particular role where he wants every one of us. He wants us to live in the center of his will. He has placed us there, and he expects us to remain there. If we leave like Elimelech did, no matter if outside of God's will looks or feels like it is the easier way, then we may have a temporary supply of bread. Our needs, our feelings may be met for a time. It may seem like that's a good place to be. But ultimately, it's not. The effects were drastic for Naomi's family. The three men died. The results in our lives will be drastic as well. Eventually, our sins may even result in the sin unto death, and God may have to take our lives. It's something that could happen if you stay there long enough. But where is it that God wants you to be right now? Wherever it is, stay there, and don't be tempted to look around. Don't develop the grass is greener on the other side of the fence syndrome. The idea that where I can't be, that's where I really want to be. If you do, you may cross that fence and find out that your green grass is actually a poisonous weed, something that God didn't intend for you to be ever experiencing, is now becoming a part of your life. So, if you are already outside of God's will, however, you can return to the place of blessing. When Naomi, Ruth returned to Israel, back to the promised land where God had wanted them in the first place. God once again opened up his hand of blessing for the family. Now, we may not have to turn around and walk 50 miles through the desert to get there, but it could be as simple as a mental decision to leave something out of our lives or to put something back into our lives that should have been there all along. But whatever it is, wherever it is, God wants us to be in the place of his will, not outside it. One more note. The pattern of temptation is especially interesting. For Elimelech and his family, it was to seek the easy way out. How often do we find ourselves looking at a hard road and an easy road, not knowing which one to take? Both might seem like, in our own eyes, good options. But the question that we need to ask in those times is, has God forbidden one of those roads? Is there an explicit point in the Bible where God has said, this is off limits? Don't go this way. Because if there is, if that's the easy way, it's not going to be the easy way in the long road. I think there is a good example in literature. In Bunyan's Bypass Meadow with Giant Despair. So as Christian was walking along the road, he saw the grass on the side of the road. It looked so good, so easy to walk on. So he hopped the fence, walked along the road, and as it got dark, he got lost and found himself in the hands of a cruel giant. That illustration might be lost on you, but ultimately, the only way that he was able to get out is by remembering the key that God had given him, promise. And God's promise is that when you are with him, he can bless you, but not when you're out of his will. A key theme in the book of Ruth is this concept of the kinsman redeemer. The kinsman redeemer was a man who acted in behalf of a relative who needed it. Let's turn to Deuteronomy 25, verses 5 and 6. Deuteronomy 25. Deuteronomy 25, verses 5 and 6. It's also up there on the screen if you need it. This is the beginning of the kinsman redeemer idea. If brethren dwell together, and one of them die, and have no child, the wife of the dead shall not marry without unto a stranger. Her husband's brother shall go in unto her, and take her to him to wife, and perform the duty of an husband's brother unto her. And it shall be that the firstborn which she beareth shall succeed in the name of his brother which is dead, that his name be not put out of Israel. So this was an important concept in ancient times because the inheritance was based off of your ability to continue to have children in your family. So if at some point, like for example the story of Ruth, there was an end to the line in sight because there were no children to carry on the family name or the inheritance, then how was the family name to keep going? So God provided by that in Israel's case by saying that the husband's brother should have a child with the wife of his brother, and that the child then would be the dead brother's son or daughter, as the case may be, to continue the inheritance in that family. So when Naomi and Ruth returned, they were penniless widows who needed both a protector and a provider. If you read all the description, you'll see that this was also part of the necessity. They fit the description. Boaz, at Ruth's request, agreed to perform the role of kinsman redeemer. And this is seen in Ruth 4, 1 through 6, and 9 through 10. Let's go ahead and turn there as well. Ruth 4, 1 through 6, and we'll skip a couple of verses there and do 9 and 10 as well. Ruth chapter 4. Ruth 4, 1 through 6, and 9 and 10. Then went Boaz up to the gate and sat him down there, and behold, the kinsman of whom Boaz spake came by. So when Ruth originally asked Boaz to be the kinsman redeemer, Boaz told Ruth, I will, but there's another kinsman who's actually closer than I am. If he won't do it, then I will. So Boaz is in the gate, and he's waiting for this man to come by so he can ask. Unto whom he said, Oh, such a one, turn aside, sit down here. And he turned aside and sat down. And he took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, Sit ye down here. And they sat down. And he said unto the kinsman, Naomi, that is come again out of the country of Moab, selleth a parcel of land, which was our brother Elimelech's. And I thought to advertise thee, saying, Buy it before the inhabitants, and before the elders of my people. If thou wilt redeem it, redeem it. But if thou wilt not redeem it, then tell me, that I may know, for there is none to redeem it besides thee, and I am after thee. And he said, I will redeem it. So the man originally thought, Great, sounds like a good deal, business transaction. I get some more land. I get to do my duty in the law at the same time. Great. Then Boaz said, What day thou buyest the field of the hand of Naomi, thou must buy it also of the Ruth. Thou must buy it also of Ruth the Moabitess, the wife of the dead, to raise up the name of the dead upon his inheritance. And the kinsman said, I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I mar mine own inheritance. Redeem thou my right to thyself, for I cannot redeem it. So when marriage was involved, he said, I can't. And then Boaz continues on in 9 and 10. Boaz said unto the elders and unto all the people, Ye are witnesses this day that I have bought all that was Elimelech's and all that was Chilion's and Mahlon's of the hand of Naomi. Moreover, Ruth the Moabitess, the wife of Mahlon, have I purchased to be my wife, to raise up the name of the dead upon his inheritance, that the name of the dead be not cut off from among his brethren and from the gate of his place. Ye are witnesses this day. So at Ruth's request, Boaz went to the gate and found this man that was a closer kinsman, said, Will you do it? He said, No. Boaz then, in the sight of the people of Bethlehem, promised that he was going to perform this role of kinsman redeemer. He bought the land that Naomi was selling, and he married Ruth to give Naomi an heir who could receive that inheritance. And this, I think, is a good demonstration of Christ in the book of Ruth. Boaz, as the kinsman redeemer, was a type of Christ. The first requirement for the kinsman redeemer was that he be a blood relation to the one who needed to be redeemed. Boaz was a near kinsman of Naomi, even though he was not directly related to Ruth. Christ became man when he was born of a virgin in Bethlehem quite a bit later. So Jesus Christ was related by blood to those he redeemed. Then the next requirement was the ability. There wasn't an expectation that a very poor person would have to perform the role of kinsman redeemer, because then that would be a burden on them as well. The expectation was that if you had the ability, then you would do it. And Boaz was apparently a very wealthy man that had no trouble paying the price that was required to redeem Naomi's inheritance. So he had his own farm. He was in charge of a lot of people. Pretty much a wealthy guy. Especially when you consider that just a few years earlier, the whole area had been in poverty and not even been able to buy bread. So he was doing pretty well. Christ could redeem humanity because he is also divine. So people could not pay for their own sin. Only someone who was God, divine, could make that payment. Jesus Christ made that payment because he was and is divine. Also, as the kinsman redeemer, he had to be willing to perform the action. The kinsman redeemer was not forced to perform the responsibility. He had to do it willingly. And we saw that with the first kinsman. He didn't want to do it because he was afraid it would mess up his own inheritance for his children. So Boaz did it instead. And apparently he was pretty willing to do it. He seems to have been very impressed with the fact that Ruth was a virtuous woman, even though, if you think about it, Proverbs 31 had not yet been written. Christ also willingly laid down his life to pay for our sins. It wasn't that he was forced to go to the cross. He did it of his own will. And then the last requirement was marriage. We read that passage indicating that marriage was a requirement to raise up the inheritance. But for the Redeemer, Boaz then performed the marriage. He got married to Ruth. But as you read the New Testament, we discover that Christ's bride is the church, the ones that he has redeemed to himself, the ones that he loves. So in a lot of ways, all four ways as a matter of fact, Christ is the Redeemer, and Boaz is a type of Christ as the kinsman Redeemer. So the key doctrine that I see in the book of Ruth is that the worship of God has always been intended for all nations, even though God chose Israel to be his special people. The seed who would crush the head of Satan was promised to Adam and Eve, who represented the entire human race. So originally in the Garden of Eden, when Adam and Eve sinned, the entire human race fell into sin, and God promised the entire human race that he would send a seed of the woman who would then crush the head of Satan and redeem men. That promise was given to all men. That's important, because then later on, when God confused humanity's languages at the Tower of Babel and forced people to scatter around the world, in order to bring his seed into the world, he had to choose one nation. He couldn't just say that it was all a group anymore, because people were divided. They couldn't understand each other, and language formed a natural barrier. Although God chose Israel to be the nation that his son was going to come through, the promise of redemption was and always has been intended for the whole world. And God always will accept those who come to him as he commands. Ruth was an example of how God will accept people who come to him. So really quickly, an overview of the book of Ruth. In chapter 1, you have Elimelech and Naomi who are ruined in Moab because they left their promised land in Bethlehem. They left Israel, Elimelech died, and then their two sons died as well, leaving Naomi, Ruth, and Orpah all widows. After that, Naomi and Ruth returned to Israel. Along the way, Naomi turns to her daughter-in-laws and says, "You don't want to go back with me. I'm bitter. I don't have anything that I can give you anymore. Go back, get married again, worship your own gods, leave me alone. What can I do for you?" Orpah decides to take her advice. She goes back to her homeland, worships her gods. But Ruth says, "No, I will follow you. Your people will be my people. Your God will be my God." Then in the second chapter of the book, Boaz discovers and provides for Ruth. So when Ruth came back to Israel with Naomi, they were forced to do whatever they could to make ends meet. And Ruth went out into the fields and started gathering grain after the harvesters so that they could have a little bit of food. Accidentally, you got to love how that word is given in the book. It says, "And her hap was to light upon the portion of the field that belonged to Boaz." So in a big accident, Ruth chose to work in Boaz's field. Of course, we know there are no accidents. And Boaz discovered her identity. And he provided her with food, extra gleanings from the harvest, taking special care of her, told her not to go anywhere else to glean during the harvest, but to stay in his field. And then in the next chapter, Boaz decides to perform the role of kinsman redeemer for Ruth and Naomi. Ruth went to meet Boaz in the threshing floor as Naomi instructed. She asked him to be the kinsman redeemer. He agreed. And then at the very end of the chapter, kind of an interesting note, Boaz gives Naomi, via Ruth, a large gift of 6 measures of barley flour. Now, I don't know how you picture Ruth, but if you picture her as a wimpy girl who really was just weak, yeah, you can change that opinion now, because a measure was equivalent to a third of an ephah, which was 10 times an omer, weighed about 1.6 kilograms. So if Ruth was carrying 2 ephahs of flour, she was carrying about 20 omers or 32 kilograms of flour, which roughly translated is well over 70 pounds of flour. And she carried this all the way back into the city and in her veil. It's quite an accomplishment. So not something that your average weakling would just up and do. She was a hard worker. Then continuing on in the fourth chapter, last chapter, Boaz performed the action of redeeming Ruth. We read the majority of this first section where Boaz went to the city elders, the rulers of the city, and said, "Come here, you're my witnesses. I'm going to do this. This is my intention." Then Boaz and Ruth have a son. The son's name is Obed. And then the end of the book traces the line of David coming from Judah down through Boaz and Ruth to David, King David. As we conclude tonight, there is one final application that I'd like to work in. Jesus Christ is still the promised seed for all nations. The Jews and Ruth had to look forward to his coming. They couldn't see it like we can, looking back on it, knowing that it's been completed. But yet he is still the promised seed. As Christians, we have received the Great Commission in Matthew 28:19-20. It's up there on the screen for you. "Go ye therefore and teach all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Ghost, teaching them to observe all things whatsoever I have commanded you. And lo, I am with you always, even unto the end of the world." How can we perform this task of the Great Commission while we are here in our local area? In one way, we can give to our missionaries who have demonstrated God's calling on their lives to leave their homes behind and go to a foreign field. Some have gone to places that have never heard of the promised seed in their entire lives, places where it's incredibly dark. But another way, we can go ourselves. It has never been easier in history to get across the world, especially for us as Americans. You realize that if you hop into a plane in Kansas City, within just over a day of travel, you can be just about anywhere in the world. That was not possible up until recently. Some of those past missionaries took a great sacrifice and went for months on ship trying to get to their lands where they felt that God was calling them. But now we can go cheaply, quickly, visit these places and develop a greater burden for them ourselves. And what good does that do? Well, short-term missions trips are a great way to gain a vision for a particular area of the world, and they can be encouraging to the missionaries if they are done correctly. Furthermore, once you have been to a place, you will be better able to pray for the people who are ministering there, and you will be more able to communicate their needs to others who are here in the States. But if we are unable to go, we can maintain contact with our missionaries on a personal level, offering them prayerful support and the benefit of talking with a familiar face from home. When I was in Thailand, I very quickly learned how nice it was to call a friend that I had here in the States. And we'd talk occasionally and share what was going on there in Thailand in ministry. He'd tell me what was going on in his place in ministry. And it was a really good thing to do. It kept us in touch with each other, and then also provided a little bit of encouragement. And that can be greatly encouraging for our missionaries, especially when they're in a place in their early terms of ministry, when they don't completely understand the language very well, and they might not understand the culture entirely, still trying to get used to driving on the other side of the road maybe, or trying to figure out why people are avoiding them at all costs. Any number of things can be discouraging. And there are numerous other ways we can participate in evangelism at home. But the primary thrust of what I'm trying to say tonight is that the Great Commission and what God's intention has always been is for those who have never heard, for all nations, to be the recipients of this promise. Actually, if you think about it, the majority of us here fall into this category because we're not Jews. We would be the Gentiles. God's promise has been extended to us, and we need to continue to share what God has given to us with the rest of the world. So are we doing the commands in these verses? Are we making disciples of all nations, whether that be at home or abroad? Are we encouraging those, helping those who are going abroad to do their work as well? As we approach this new year, let's do our part to tell all the nations of the world that Jesus Christ is the promised seed who has brought salvation from sin and restoration to fellowship with God. Thank you very much for coming tonight, and let's divide up for prayer.